the Tom and Curly Show. Tom Tangney here. Sherry Elliker filling in for John. This next story, we've been having a great couple of hours of conversation, Sherry and I, and it's really been fun and enjoyable. And I've got to admit, this next story is about as awful as stories come. There's nothing good that seems to be coming out of this story. If you've listened to Cairo at all today, I'm sure you've heard it on every one of our talk shows. We do need to address it. And this is the absolutely tragic case of a 15-year-old SeaTac girl who's now charged with murder in a hit-and-run death in July, back in July, of a guy named Greg Moore, who a 53-year-old guy who's just jogging in the early morning hours. He's hit and killed, left for dead in the street. 7 weeks go by. His widow has to, you know, wonder what could have brought this about. How could this have happened? Why did it happen? It's so unfortunate. Word leaked a couple of days ago, maybe last week, I guess it was, that it was a 15-year-old girl behind the wheel. So obviously, she, you know, it wasn't even her car. She was obviously driving without a license. You can't get a license at that age. What could have happened? The charging papers came down yesterday, and it turns out that according to the criminal charges, which are, you know, which have been leveled as second degree felony murder and felony hit and run, the girl had a 14-year-old passenger with her. She intentionally hit this jogger, not to kill him, she says, but to maybe give him a scare. Apparently, they laughed after they hit them. They hit him. They hit poor Greg Moore, and then they went back to look at the body, and then drove off. And for 7 weeks, said nothing to anybody until the cops finally figured out putting enough, videotape together and whatever kind of tips they could have gotten. She finally turned herself in, and now she's facing these charges. The widow, understandably, is absolutely furious and has talked to the press. I think before we get into general discussion of this, Sherry, let's hear some of the audio about what's happening, why it's happening, and how painful it is to hear it happening.
Instead of celebrating with him, I am here alone, alone in this world without my partner. She went on about her life for 7 weeks, 7 weeks of torture for my family and me. I would argue that the brutality of her crime and blatant disregard for human life warrant her being tried as an adult.
So that is where most of the discussion is happening, as sad and as tragic as this case is. A lot of the discussion now is in the decision to charge her not as an adult, but as a juvenile. That is a lot of people, including Greg's widow, are making that case. But what we have today is Casey McNerthy, who is a representative of the prosecutor's office, was on the Gian Ursula show, and he tried his best to explain why, as horrible as this crime is, why it didn't rise to the level of her or allowed the prosecutors to even think of charging her as an adult.
When you're 15, that's a juvenile court case, you know, and that's really it. If you're 16 or 17 and you're charged with murder, automatically across Washington State, that goes to adult court. Those are called auto adult cases. And so if this, you know, were a 16-year-old, then we wouldn't be in a spot. But when you're 15 or 14 or 13, that leaves a difficult decision for prosecutors of is this an adult case? And we could kick the can down the road, and we've had people outside our office say, well, why don't you just say something to make it look better for optics? But what we know is that it's very unlikely that a juvenile court judge would approve the move to adult court, which is what has to happen. It's not our choice here.
And then one last clip before we start talking about this. He says the prosecutor's office understands people's frustration.
We understand if people are frustrated with us, and that's their right to send us a note and to call us and to say that we're terrible. That's fine. We're not trying to argue with the family or people who are frustrated with us. One thing that I think would be effective is state lawmakers are the ones that set the auto adult for people who are 16 and 17. You know, if folks want 15-year-olds to be charged as adults, state lawmakers are the ones who can change that, not just in King County, but statewide. I'm not sure that would have a lot of support, but that is certainly a route that could do it.
Okay, so Sherry, in our pre-show meeting, you mentioned that this hits a little closer to home for you than for a lot of us. Why don't you explain your personal circumstances?
Sure. So back in January, and I've talked about this on the air, my husband was hit by a car. A guy ran a stop sign, and he was walking the dogs, and he was hit, and he had a traumatic brain injury. Now, the guy that hit him did stay with him, did call 911, and probably saved his life because he did call and wow, render help. But, you know, he is still suffering. He's lost his smell, his taste. He's lost a lot of his hearing. He will, cognitively, he's in very, very good shape, but they don't really know what the long term is on something like this. So for me, I think that when you talk about something like being hit with a car not being murder, or that it doesn't rise to the level of murder, or it's, you know, vehicular this, or it's nonviolent or whatever, I have a real problem with that, because it is. A car is a weapon. And this young woman used that car as a weapon to take somebody out. They had a chance to call 911, even if they didn't mean to do it or they were goofing around. They could have called 911. They went back and looked at the body and had another chance to call 911, and they absolutely didn't do it. And when I worked for the prison system, I was on a parole board. I was in a parole board hearing where a woman had been very drunk, and she hit a bicyclist, and the bicyclist actually went through her windshield. That's how hard she hit him. And she was charged with vehicular manslaughter. She was sent to prison for 7 years, but she was going to get out in 4, and she was up for parole after 4 years. And the public was outraged at this, because they were saying this, because after there's a certain amount of time that you only have to serve part of your sentence if it's considered a nonviolent crime. And okay, so everybody was saying, this, how could this not be a nonviolent crime? How could this not be murder? Mm-hmm. And that's kind of the way I feel about this, is that, yes, I understand she was 15 years old, and I understand that she probably had no intention whatsoever of doing that much harm to one human being. But there has to be consequences for this type of thing. There has to be something more than her doing 3 years in juvie. I just don't think it's enough. I don't think there's any solution. I don't think anything's going to change. And you know, he's right. The only thing that can happen is you can toss it up to a juvenile court judge. They're not going to go for that. So the family is stuck with this horrible tragedy, and she gets to go scot-free. I mean, it's horribly unfair.
So, just to clarify, so she has been charged with second-degree felony murder. So it is a murder charge. It's just second degree. I assume that you're thinking maybe first degree would be more like a murder charge that you would feel would be appropriate, or?
Well, I guess first degree would have to show that it was
intent,
premeditated in some way.
Yes,
so
right.
I just think that it is absolutely, okay, because it is murder, and it's not just, I got into an terrible accident and I made a mistake while I was driving. This was an intentional act. I don't think that she thought when she was, you know, I don't think it was premeditated where they got in the car and said, hey, let's mow somebody down. I don't believe that. But I do believe that it was intentional, if what they're saying is true.
So Dory interviewed the widow again and today, and we just played a clip of it earlier in the hour. In which she said, he asked her, what was your reaction when you found out it was a 15-year-old that was the cause of the death of your husband? And she said her initial impact was empathy. Oh, my God, a 15-year-old. But then when she heard that it was, she had a chance to, you know, call 911 or stay with the body, or that didn't need to laugh at it and thought it all was a game, didn't turn herself in until she knew she was about to be arrested or caught. She says that infuriates her, and whatever empathy she initially might have felt for her age went out the window, and now she just thinks it's a mockery of the court system to think that this girl, this 15-year-old, can't be charged. It's very powerful stuff. Interestingly enough, so I listened to parts of the Gene Ursula show, and one of the interesting aspects of their discussion was the role of age. I think in general, societies around the world and through the ages have acknowledged that children need to be treated differently than adults. And then the question always is, what is the cutoff? The assumption, by the way, I heard in Dory's clip was that she would serve maybe up to 6 years. If she's 15, I think that she could be in custody for till she's 21. So it's not just 3 years. It's not 18, but it's 6 years. But the question is, at what point do you not get the full force of the law leveled against you? One of the, Gene Ursula was talking about this. Ursula was talking about, well, it's the gravity of the crime. So if the crime is, grievous enough, a 16 or 17 year old who's, being charged with murder, that would automatically, I think, be bumped up into, to adult court. But we've made the determination that 16 would be the cutoff. 18, you're an adult, 16 to 17 if it's really egregious. The other side of that discussion, G brought up was, okay, so at what point would this terrible crime not be charged, would we not want to charge this person as an adult? If 15 seems like that's adult worthy, would 14 be adult worthy? Would 13, would 12, 11, 10, at what point would we acknowledge absolutely this kid is a child or not? And these are impossible questions to answer, I'm afraid, but it does raise the stickiness of these kinds of situations. So I was trying to figure out, like a Solomon-esque kind of response to this. I'm wondering, how would you feel? It's not going to satisfy, as G recognized this morning, if that happened to his, if that was his wife who died like that, he would want that person immediately get life in prison. We all understand that the rage of the family member, of the widow involved. But the question is, how can we acknowledge the age and still get an appropriate response? It might be that, let's say, if you're charged with murder and you're 15 and you can't be charged like an adult would be, that maybe we would make you stay under supervision for longer. Like, instead of getting out at 21, maybe you'd have to serve like double the time. So if you're 15, you'd have to wait until you're 25 or 26. So that would be like a 10-year sentence. Would that be enough? Another thing I thought of is, what if we just made this person, whenever she got out, again, this is assuming that she'll be found guilty. There may be other mitigating circumstances we're not aware of, but it certainly seems like this is an airtight case. What if we said that, okay, you get out, you're a juvenile, fair enough, you get out at 21, but for the next 20 years, you need to do X amount of community service, something good for the community so that she is constantly aware of her duty to society for making amends. Do you think that, as someone who's closer to being a family member of a victim of this kind of a crime than any of the rest of us, do you think that would satisfy anyone? Or do you just think we should, it's so horrible, she should be considered as an adult and let the consequences carry themselves out?
It's very complicated, Tom, because I think that there would be some value in her doing something to repair the damage in whatever way, whether it be community service, giving back to people, doing something like that. That's very, mm-hmm. very hard, though, to legislate or to enforce. It's hard to get people to do things. You can do community service, but those things are a little tricky. And, the Supreme Court ruled a couple of years ago that a juvenile cannot be held for a life sentence without the possibility of parole. That's considered cruel and unusual punishment. And I agree with that completely. I think somebody that goes to prison when they're 15 years old, I don't think they should do more than 30 or 40 years. I don't think it does anybody any good. They're a totally different person at that point. Mm-hmm. So I don't think that this needs to be a lifelong thing. However, I just think that there are certain guidelines that you can look at in the adult system and see what those are and apply them to this. So if it were, second degree murder, what would that be? And however she can, whatever that ends up being, whether she's on probation for another 18 years or something like that, whatever that is, to fulfill that sentence that way, at the very minimum.
Okay. And then any kind of mitigating circumstances do you think would play into this? For instance, I heard that Gary Horker contacted Ursula during their show, and he said, by the way, that it sounds like her parents weren't, you know, part of the picture. She was staying with a distant relative. It was that maybe relative's car that that she had taken without permission. Do you think that given the heinousness of this particular crime, that doesn't matter the circumstances in which this 15-year-old grew up or not?
Well, I mean, that's a tough question. I mean, obviously, there are circumstances.
That's what we do on
where,
the Tom and Curly Show. That's tough questions.
I mean, yes and no. Yes, do I believe that if she's got a troubled background and that she didn't have ideal circumstances, that, yes, that is a factor in so many things psychologically in terms of what she's going through. However, I don't believe that this was just some kid that, you know, made a little mistake. I mean, she was out to do something and it turned out terribly wrong, and she had the chance to make it okay. If she had just called 911, she didn't even have to stay with the person, but if she had just called 911, that would have been something. So I do believe at 15 you do know the difference between right and wrong.
Sure.
No matter what your circumstances are, you just do.
And that's the thing that has to haunt the widow every day, every night, for the rest of her life, fact that her husband was lying there, dying with no response.
Yeah. For hours.
It's really
He went out at like 6:15. They didn't find him till 11 o'clock. He could have been saved, maybe. I mean, it's possible that he was still alive.
Like I said, this is just an awful story, and my heart goes out to the widow like nobody's business. It's about as bad as things can get. Okay. Well, we made it through the worst. Sherry, I hope that things perk up a bit. But I do think that it's a really important societal question we all have to grapple with. How to deal with kids who aren't adults but act as heinously as adults do, and what are the consequences for all of us in the final say. It's just a terrible story. Okay, well, thanks for your kind of personal wisdom on that, your individual take. I appreciate that. And now I understand the baseball game is over. I don't know if we won or lost, Tracy.
Do you want to know?
Oh, it sounds like we lost.
That doesn't sound good.
Do you really want to know, Tom? I mean, when we're so close, so far.
We can't lose two in a row to Boston. It sounds like we did.
Oh,
okay,
gosh.
Well, anyway.
Four games back. Oh,
yeah, oh, my God. You're listening to the Tom and Curly Show. Tom Tangney here. Sherry Elliker filling in for John today. So, I don't know how familiar you are with cross-state rivalries here in the great Pacific Northwest, but Washington State is the proud institution that Jacob can call his own, and I'm an avid Washington Husky fan. And so this next story, I think, I have to be careful because I want to turn it into just a football story and kind of complain about, you know, those idiots that, you know, like the Cougars and the idiots that like the Huskies and all of that. And it's actually a much more serious story. We're talking about the WSU football coach, Nick Rolovich. And in addition to the fact that he has managed to coach his team to a victory so far in the first two, and my Washington Huskies are 0-2 and looking like it could be a long season for us, I'm going to set that all aside and just talk about not the football rivalry we have, but rather his reaction to the COVID-19 vaccine requirement. Nick Rolovich is, I don't know, you'd say famous. I don't know how famous Cougar coaches are, but when the Pac-12 coaches all had their get together at the beginning, you know, in the preseason, to deal with the public, he was the only one that wasn't, you know, that had to do it by Zoom because he was unvaccinated, and the rules, Pac-12 rules, were that you can't get together unless you're vaccinated. He was very vocal about the fact that he wasn't telling anybody else what to do, or if you want to get a vaccine, that's fine, but he just wasn't, you know, going to going to do that. Now that there's a mandate from the governor that says, yes, indeed, he has to be mandated as a state employee. He has to be vaccinated as a state employee or seek a religious or a medical exemption, I think. He's still being coy with the press when the media asks him about it in their sort of not necessarily post game, but in their press conferences during the week in preparation for the next game. So we have a clip. I think we'll only need to have one, although we have a couple of clips. This is Chris Ingles from Channel 5 asking Coach Rolovich what he plans to do now with the governor's mandate on the horizon to get vaccinated.
Have you received your shot or have you scheduled your shot?
Yeah, I'm not going to talk about that, Chris. I understand what you guys are trying to get to, but
are you seeking a religious or medical exemption?
I'm not going to talk about that either, Chris.
What's been your hesitation with talking about it more forthcoming?
I don't know that it's all that positive to get deep into it with the media the way it's going. So I'm just going to try to keep that to myself and concentrate on being a coach here.
Okay, now that kind of a cat and mouse game went on for a number of more minutes. I think you get the basic a pitch. He doesn't want to talk about it. He doesn't want to address it. He's respectful. The coach, he's not, you know, lambasting the press for get off my back. It's my own, you know, business or something. He just refuses to deal with it. And Nick Rolovich is a relatively new coach at Washington State. I don't know enough about him to say. The previous coach, I think, was a much more flamboyant kind of guy. And if he was unvaccinated, I think he might be out and proud about it. I can't tell if he's, since he's not telling us, I don't know if he's kind of a knucklehead that thinks vaccines are, you know, a government plot to, you know, take over the minds of Americans, or if he has serious medical and or religious exemptions. My initial reaction to his refusal to talk is one of annoyance. It irritates me, I suppose, to some degree. It feels like he's making a more selfish decision or taking his own personal values and sacrificing the social responsibility he might have as a public figure to be much more open about it. But ultimately, I guess if we want to give him the benefit of the doubt, maybe he has a medical exemption that he doesn't want to admit to yet, which is his right, and or a religious exemption. I'm not quite sure why one couldn't just say that, but he has his own private reasons. And I guess as irritated as I am by his behavior, I'm not sure that it's worth getting all worked up about. Where do you stand from clear across the country about the controversy about the Washington State Cougar football coach?
Well, I guess he's going to have to answer to something because there's an October 18th deadline. And yes. If he's the highest paid state employee, my guess is he's not going to want to give that up. But the question is, does he have an obligation to reveal his personal medical decisions to the press? Is that really something that he has to do? I think it's annoying as well. I think that he should be forthcoming. And since you don't really know what this guy's personality is like you said, if it was somebody very flamboyant, you'd be able to guess that they were doing this because that's the way they handle things. But it's hard to tell just from listening to him what his real objection is. Is it that he just doesn't think it's anybody's business? Or does he have a real some sort of moral or medical or religious or whatever problem with the vaccine itself, and that feels like it's too personal, muddy, whatever, to get into it. But he's going to have to do something, right?
Yes. Well, in fact, and this is the one thing, and this is why I'm willing to just sort of back away and say, okay, fine. He claims that he will follow the COVID-19 vaccine mandate from the governor. He's not shaking his fist in the air and I'm here to defy the governor. He's not saying that. He's saying he's going to follow the mandate. Well, the mandate dictates that he has to get vaccinated or he gets a religious and medical exemption. So I'm just going to have to assume, since whoever writes his check, you know, Washington State or whatever, he's going to have to fess up to somebody about what he did to play by these rules, unless he joins a lawsuit, but then that would be public information as well. I'm just going to assume that he has he gets an exemption, you know, we'll sort of carry on. But I just don't know why. Dory had a firefighter. I don't know if he was a Seattle firefighter or what, but Dory had a firefighter on who just says for religious reasons he wasn't going to get a vaccination. Apparently, they ruled against him, saying that they allow for the religious exemption, but there's no way to accommodate his, you know, dealing with the public. They can't find him another job that wouldn't deal with it, and so he might be facing his own, he might be facing a job loss as a result. But at least, you know, I don't understand why Nick Rolovich can't come forth like that. If it's a religious exemption, just say it's a religious exemption. I can't find it in my heart of hearts to do this, and just be public about it. That's, I think, more people would respect him for whatever exemption he's seeking. But for whatever reasons, he wants to keep it private, and I guess we'll just have to trust that whoever is employing him will do their due diligence and make sure that he's following the vaccine mandate. So defend your college, Jacob. How do you feel about your coach?
Oh, no. I would say, Tom, that it feels like both of our schools are just in a race to the bottom to embarrass ourselves as much as we can this year. I don't know. It feels like, to me personally, WCU might be edging you out right now, but I know that we do have the one win. So
yeah. We'll see. Once we get a win under our belt, I'll be a little cockier about it. So, okay, fair enough. Okay, Tracy, more bad news. Apparently the Mariners lost their second against Boston in their race to make the wild card, and traffic's bad as a result. You're listening to the Tom and Curly Show. Sherry Ellicker in for John today. This is always one of our favorite times of this show because we get to look over the horizon and watch for the mailman.
I'm the mailman. As you can see, I'm the mailman. Don't nobody mess with me. I'm the mailman. If you didn't know, I'm the mailman. I bring the mail to your door.
Okay, Sherry, let's start off. We got lots of letters, lots of responses. Go ahead and take off.
Okay. The first one is The Squirrel, area code 253, says, I'm sorry Sherry missed the squirrel saga. I did hear a little bit about it. So
that's all right. We talked in the pre-show about it as well.
That's great.
On the Washington State Patrol study that we led our show with, area code 425 weighs in, the solution to lawlessness isn't eliminating laws, and photo enforcement is not enforceable when you just have to deny being the driver to be found not guilty.
Area code 425 says the most dangerous things cops do are traffic stops. More cops are assaulted, injured, or killed on traffic stops than any other public contact.
Area code 360, all they do is stop commercial vehicles anymore anyways. Most of us are out here just trying to make a living.
Area code 360 says if there is cooperation with police, there are less problems with better outcomes. Might want to look at bias regarding behavior by race towards police.
On Sherry filling in, Hugh and Raymond speculates, hey, Tom, I just realized something. If you keep having Sherry on, you just might beat Dory in the ratings. That was a reference to Dory has a promo about how the highest rated show in the land, and it got under John's skin a bit. But yeah, why do you think we asked John not to be here today? We wanted to improve our ratings. Yuck, yuck, yuck. Okay, carry on, Sherry.
Area code 253 says, pleasant conversation. That's not why I tune into this show. I'm here for a one-sided screaming match.
Pretty good. And area code 425, got it, Tom. Yeah, I was channeling John somewhat facetiously there. Thanks, 425.
City Hall Park, area code 206 says they may have cleared out the park and closed it, but all the people are still in downtown. They just moved their tents farther towards the retail district.
And area code 425 weighs in, and the King County Sheriff's Department is short-staffed too. They aren't as bad off as SPD, but short-handed nonetheless.
How to fight, area code 206 says 1 year, that's too long.
Yeah, even the people that instituted that goes contract talks, they ended up shorting it to four times a year, every 3 months, I think. Yeah. Area code 360. This is about how to fight fair. 360 says this type of addressing problems only works as long as there isn't 365 notes asking to leave the toilet seat down. Yeah, I think after the fifth or sixth time you write that, you may say, oh, forget it. I'll just bring it up in the year.
Yeah. Area code 253 says, Tom, my ex-husband, never wanted to talk. He was the best pouter, hence the ex.
And now it is time for the letter of the day.
Maybe you needed a contract talk. Now, the letter of the day comes from area code 206. Hey, I missed the beginning of the show. Is John out for Blackie's funeral? Blackie, the name of the late lamented squirrel that his dogs
R.I.P. Blackie.
Delivered to his heavenly reward. Anyway, three cheers for Blackie and three cheers for Sherry. That was great. I'm really happy you had the chance to spend an afternoon with me, and maybe we'll do it soon. Again.
Sounds like a plan.
That's all she wrote.
That's all she wrote.
Then ride no more.
Then ride no more. Let's do one more hour.
Hanging round my front door.